10 a.m. W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Another dome in Washington, D.C. This one's the Heat Dome. Temperatures there, along with much of the Northeast, in the mid-90s right now. Galen Clark says it's better in Las Vegas, where she's from.
120 in Vegas, it's hot, but you have air conditioning everywhere you go. Every car has air conditioning. There's places to get out of the heat.
Threat of an escalation of fighting in the Middle East, with Hezbollah exchanging increasing fire with Israel from Lebanon. The group has said it will not stop until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. This is Israel's Defense Minister Yoav Gallant heads to Washington to meet face-to-face with U.S. officials, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is claiming that the U.S. has cut back on military supply shipments. The USS Theodore Roosevelt nuclear-powered aircraft carrier reaching port in South Korea for planned military drills, which also will include Japan. This just days after Russian President Putin's warning about arming North Korea. This is ABC News. Alarms sounding over security breaches at the Euro 2024 soccer tournament. Saturday's game between Portugal and Turkey had to be stopped four times after fans ran onto the pitch for selfies with soccer superstar Cristiano Ronaldo. Portugal's coach calling it a concern, urging fans to stop. In Pittsburgh today, groundbreaking for a new Tree of Life synagogue, the site of the mass shooting in 2018, the deadliest attack on American Jews in U.S. history. Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff at the ceremony urging all Americans to stand against anti-Semitism.
We must never forget what poison, what anti-Semitism can do, and that we all have a responsibility to stand up to hate, not through words, not through empty words, and not through silence, but through action.
11 people were killed in that shooting. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute and a quick hack for setting and reaching a money goal. Try the SMART system for organizing your approach. S is for specific. What exactly is the goal? I want to save a down payment to buy my first house. M is for measurable. How will you know when you're done? I want to save $50,000. A is for achievable. Well, I'm going to have to cut spending in a few places, but I can save $1,000 a month. R is for relevant. Raising my kid in a home that we own is important for me and for her. I want her to grow up in the same place if we can afford it. And T is time. How long is it going to take? I think I can do this in about 4 years. Thinking through each of those letters is a great way to set yourself up for success when you're making money plans. For more tips on saving more and spending less, head on over to workmoney.org. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying take good care.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Changes in the brain can happen up to 20 years before a person is diagnosed with Alzheimer's. As Mark Moran reports, scientists want more public education about the early warning signs.
There are at least 7 million people aged 65 and older in the U.S. living with Alzheimer's. Abby Meisner with the Alzheimer's Association says despite time and money being spent on research, the risk is going up at a younger age, and the numbers are discouraging.
The lifetime risk for Alzheimer's at age 45 is 1 in 5 for women and 1 in 10 for men.
Meisner says those numbers hold true across the board for Blacks and Latinos as well. She adds now that doctors know signs and symptoms could start to occur at an earlier age, they're paying attention to signs sooner. Meisner adds earlier detection gives doctors a chance to intervene sooner in a patient's care.
As many as 40% of dementia cases may be attributed to modifiable risk factors. So things like having too high of blood pressure or not enough physical activity, lack of exercise, things like that, getting good sleep, all of those things are so important.
And all of those things can be controlled by developing healthy living habits. But a 2022 Alzheimer's Association report shows 60% of people will put off seeing a doctor if they develop symptoms early on, waiting until the symptoms worsen or until family and friends encourage them to seek treatment. The association is holding educational events all month. This is Mark Moran. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine for your Sunday. Some showers and storms, especially going into the afternoon. Highs climbing to the middle 70s, light northwest winds. Overnight, mostly clear. We'll see upper 40s and lower 50s. Sunshine on Monday. Currently 71 degrees.
Maggie Dawn.
It is day 16 and week 4 of Joe Biden's Top 100. Our theme this week, healthcare. You're not going to want to miss a single episode.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to this, our weekly, our weekend venued broadcast here on the stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin and well beyond. My name is Jim Santel, and yes, I am your on-air host for the next 2 hours here on Amicus, a law review. Our broadcast this weekend, as always, as you now well know, takes its name from our adopted and embraced commission. That is to conduct a review, an examination, sometimes an analysis, a deep analysis, as we will do today, a deliberation of some of those recent news stories of our times in those areas of law and government, and yes, beyond that, the aspiration for justice in America, sometimes throughout our world. Amicus, as you know, this legal term, it comes from Latin. It is describing a friend, an individual, an organization that assists in some way in promoting understanding, appreciation of some relevant issues, tension resolution by some entity, some group that needs to make a decision about something that is important in our lives. We offer, therefore, information, insight, perspective, sometimes even some expertise. And that is indeed our mission, our purpose, our goal on this broadcast that also involves you this weekend, as it does every weekend here on Amicus Law Review. We have and always will continue to invite your questions, especially your inquiries about the subject matters that are on our ambitious but achievable agenda, our syllabus every week. Phone number is 844-967-2789. Once more, that's 844-967-2789. Or you can text us. Drop us a note into our feed on the Civic Media app. Let us know what your question or comment may be. Along with Max here in the studios of Civic Media in downtown Waukesha, we'll be taking your questions, your inquiries throughout our two-hour period this weekend on Amicus, a law review, joined as always by you in our conversation or discussion of the rule of law-related topics of our day. Thank you for once again joining me this hour and perhaps the next hour as well on this, our broadcast on the Civic Media stations. What is our syllabus? What is our academic agenda for this weekend? As always, focusing upon rule of law issues, this is once again this heavy time, this exciting time in the lifeblood of our nation when our United States Supreme Court continues to issue some major opinions on issues, questions, challenges that animate who we are as a nation, animate who we are as a people in our country. This is the time every single year at the end of its term, actually kind of three quarters of the way through its term. The term actually continues through the end of September. But this is the time period when the Supreme Court issues its principal decisions in this term, some 62, count them, 62 cases the Supreme Court has heard during the course of this present term, the 2023-2024 term. It's back in business again come October 1 of this year and continuing in well into next year. Already on things that we'll report down the road on this broadcast, the Supreme Court beginning to issue what's called writs of certiorari. These are these orders that are sent to lower courts that identify those cases that it is going to be reviewing, analyzing, and giving us some rulings on in the next year. Already in the weeks, actually the months of recent times, our Supreme Court has been issuing these writs of certiorari and beginning to populate its docket for the coming year. And we're going to be talking about some of those cases down the road. Today, our focus is on the immediate issues. And that is this time in our history, every single year, June and sometimes into July as well, when our United States Supreme Court issues these major decisions in rulings that have been pending before it sometimes for more than a year, certainly during the previous term itself. We know based upon the inventory of the Supreme Court that it has about nine decisions of just this past week. We're going to talk about two of those in particular in this broadcast of Amicus Law Review. One of them has to do with guns. That's right, a guns-related decision. The second gun-related decision of this term. And then, although this sounds boring and wonky, the reality is we're also going to be talking about a tax-related decision. A tax-related decision that also has some great implications for the future and some commentary, arguably, on the future viability of things called a wealth tax or wealth taxes, much the subject of political debate in the Congress and outside of the Congress. We'll talk about those cases called Rahimi, that's the guns case, and Moore, that's the tax case. Beyond that, we're also going to go back down to Fort Pierce, Florida. That is where Judge Eileen Cannon is in the middle. That's right, the middle of 3 days of hearings in that case involving the Mar-a-Lago documents, the case involving our former president, arguably our future president named Donald Trump, and his allegedly illegal taking, acquisition, perhaps even use of classified and non-classified documents in violation of federal law. She's got that case in front of her. She's conducting some pre-trial hearings. We're going to talk about what the subject matter of those is, and then also review the status of her cases generally. We're going to talk very, very generally about the kinds of things she's doing. I'll tantalize you by telling you that part of the perspective I'm going to offer today falls in the categories of three different D words that describe what's going on right now in that federal district court in South Florida. We'll be spending a lot of time talking about Eileen Cannon and the pendency of that case. And then we necessarily need to stay in the South, but a few states to the west. And that is Louisiana. Again, a state where a legislature has passed some laws, a law in particular, that requires the posting of, that's right, the Ten Commandments in public schools and universities throughout that state. We're going to talk about what the legislature has done in that particular state. And also, of course, the Supreme Court implications for that. The teaser on that, the heads up on that is that the Supreme Court has already determined that the posting of these kinds of things inside of public schools, way back in 1980, issued its decision on this, found it unconstitutional. Nonetheless, Louisiana, the legislature there, just this past week, in violation of Supreme Court law, has decided to take this up again, a part of another process here that we see in many instances, that is returning to the past, this reliance upon present views that are contrary to what our history has been, contrary to what the law is, but an attempt to turn back time. I'm going to talk about that a little bit in connection not only with that particular case, but also about other things coming out of the Supreme Court, a lot of them having to do with Clarence Thomas and his continuing articulation, even as he dissents in the Rahimi case, his focus on the past and his belief that the present term and the present terms of the Supreme Court should be almost exclusively focused on things that have happened in the past, plainly does not believe in a living constitution, but continues to articulate this fundamental premise in his opinions, principally his dissent, as we will see this weekend in Rahimi, his dissenting a view that all of the legislative actions by a locality, by a county, by a state, by the federal legislature have to pass muster through the lens of history. And absent that, they cannot be condoned. They cannot be supported. They cannot be found constitutional. We'll talk about that continuing reference to the past, this notion that somehow our nation needs to go back to a time before the present and not adopt and embrace the notion that our country is guided by a living constitution that necessarily responds to the times in which we live. Lots and lots of things to discuss here on our weekend presentation of all things justice related, rule of law related here on Amicus, a law review. As always, Max and I, my terrific producer, inviting your inquiries, your questions here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. That number 844-967-2789. Amicus, a law review. Our discussion begins right now. As I said, the Supreme Court in this period of time, typically late May into June and perhaps even into July this year, they've done that from time to time, gone into the early days of July, may or may not be doing that this term. We know, once again, that just this past week, in cutting back on its backlog, if you will, of cases that it got to resolve and present to us as members of the Supreme Court, they issued nine opinions, nine different cases just this past week. We're going to focus once again on two of those, not only because of the substance of what they say, the importance in the area of guns, and yes, indeed, taxes, but also because of the implications of those, one having to do with, again, this history tradition focus, and the other having to do with the prospects in the future for a wealth tax, that is, imposing taxes upon people based upon their present wealth, something advocated for by Elizabeth Warren, other senators, the United States Senate, many other politicians out there saying that this is a way in which not only to address some of our deficits at the federal system, but also equalizing, if you will, requiring that people with great wealth pay their fair share, an awful lot of advocacy for that. It shows up this week in a decision of the United States Supreme Court called Moore versus United States of America. There are 15 more, 15 on the docket of the Supreme Court yet to be decided in this term. 15 more cases. Those include a second abortion case. That's the case coming out of Idaho, whether or not the Idaho abortion ban, the nearly prohibitive ban on abortion there, supersedes if it trumps the federal law that requires that medical doctors in that state and throughout the nation requiring them to provide life-saving treatment, maybe in the form of an abortion, to keep mothers alive and doing well. That issue still to be resolved by the United States Supreme Court. We've got two major social media cases coming up that implicate the interaction between executive branches and legislative branches when it comes to the interplay between what you can post on social media platforms and what you cannot post. And then we've also got a couple of cases involving agency. We've talked a lot about this, the discretion vested in federal courts, not vested in federal courts, to decide to defer to federal agencies, the experts, when it comes to making decisions about important issues. Two major cases, one involving a case called Loper Bright Enterprises. We'll talk about that as soon as the Supreme Court issues that major case. We've talked about this before. It's called Chevron deference. Would be a dramatic change in the way that our federal courts interact with our federal agencies. And yes, indeed, we're still waiting for those two cases coming out of the Supreme Court having to do with the pendency of that other major criminal case against Donald Trump. That's the ones, the election interference case. It's pending in front of the judge in the District of Columbia. And she right now has suspended any trial on that case while the Supreme Court determines incredibly whether our executive, our chief executive, has a right to claim complete immunity for crimes that he, maybe one day she, commits in the federal office of the United States of America. That is the presidency in the West Wing, in the Oval Office. An incredible thing even to be discussing openly. And second, whether the statutory basis for at least two of those counts pending in front of that judge can continue. All of that on our academic syllabus coming up this weekend on Amicus Law Review. Stay with us and join us for that all-important discussion here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for matinee on air.
Look up cheese curds, you'll find this basic definition, wet pieces of curdled milk.
Huh?
Well, it should also include the word delicious. As we continue to celebrate June Dairy Month, do you know how much milk is needed to make 1 pound of cheese curds? 16 ounces, 64 ounces, or 160 ounces, 10 pounds of milk? The answer coming up.
It actually is a sound of freshness.
Rachel Kerr is talking about squeaky milky curds. She's with the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and a bit of a cheese nerd.
Those elastic protein strands rub against the enamel of your teeth and create that characteristic sound.
The squeak turns stretchy when battered and deep fried. Some believe the idea to fry globs of cheese happened by accident. I consider it a happy accident. Okay, did you guess? It takes 10 pounds of milk, which is a big gallon jug plus a little bit more, to make 1 pound of squeaky cheese curds. Call me your curd girl for this slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name, Jim Santel. I'm with you this hour and also next hour, spending most of our time this weekend on our broadcast, talking once again about the Supreme Court. This is that time. This is that season in American history every year when the Supreme Court issues some of its most significant decisions. This past week, no exception to that, nine different opinions issued by our United States Supreme Court, including two that we're going to spend some time focusing on, always inviting your inquiries, your questions here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, 844-967-2789. Text us, call us, Max and I will get those inquiries into our discussion this weekend. Let's talk about this major case. You all know about it because it's been all over the news. The Supreme Court on Friday of this past week found that the government, the United States of America, the United States Department of Justice, and other entities of our federal government can indeed take guns away from people who are subject to restraining orders for domestic violence. It is significant that even as one says that out loud, that should be a question before the United States Supreme Court. Nonetheless, it has been, and it is. The question whether or not someone who has been found by a state court, a finding that there should be a domestic violence restraining order against them, that is restraining them from engaging with other identified people based upon their history of domestic violence. That's right, domestic violence. The question is whether or not those people should be permitted to have firearms. And indeed, there is a federal law. I prosecuted under it on many occasions as a United States attorney and an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Prosecutors use this all the time. A federal law that prohibits someone facing and under the rubric of a domestic violence restraining order from holding, possessing, using in any way a firearm. That is the law. And if you do that, you are subject to criminal prosecution. On Friday, the Supreme Court issued this major case involving Mr. Rahimi, Zakay Rahimi. We're going to talk about exactly who he is, what he did. And it is in many ways a retreat from what has been recently a fairly unbroken series of major rulings favoring gun rights. It started way back in 2008. We have talked a lot about this on this broadcast. 2008, Justice Antonin Scalia issues this major opinion in a case called Heller, coming out of the District of Columbia, articulates for the first time in our nation's history, uninterrupted cases up until that time, until 2008, finding that the Second Amendment, the language of it, does not invest in every American a personal individual right to handgun possession. 2008, the Supreme Court reverses that hundreds of years position and says that indeed there is in the Second Amendment, in the language, in the history of that, footnote that because we're going to get back to that issue of history, that there is indeed inside the Second Amendment a constitutional provision that mandates that a recognition of your right to possess and use a weapon in the home for self-defensive purposes, that is constitutional, a break in all the tradition that proceeded up to that time. Following that in many years after that, in a case called Bruin issued by the Supreme Court in the wake of Heller, finding that constitutional right that apparently invests from the Supreme Court continues beyond the home, and that you also have a right to carry, to use a weapon outside in the public domain. That's Bruin. And significantly in Bruin, the reason why this history is so very relevant is that Bruin was also the case written by, authored by Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas articulates once again his longstanding and repeated view that the basis for any legislation passed by our federal legislature, our Congress, can only be justified, can only be supported if it has an analog, an antecedent, a basis in, yes, that's right, the past, in history. We don't look at what's going on today in contemporary America. We've got to find a basis in the past to support that. And that test, the so-called Bruin test, in 2022 is the time that the Supreme Court issues Bruin. That test has confounded the lower courts, the federal appellate courts, the district courts since that time. And an awful lot of people looked at this case called Rahimi, to determine what the Supreme Court is going to do in principle, because it posed a great conundrum for the Supreme Court in terms of deciding on the merits, the facts of this case, and yet also determining whether Bruin continues to be good law. Is it a tenable, is it a viable standard to continue to address the basis for any present legislation by looking to the past? The case decided Friday, again, United States v. Rahimi, was asking whether a Texas man could be prosecuted under this federal law that made it a crime, as I said, for people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders to possess guns. Chief Justice John Roberts, he's writing for the majority, a good sign, an 8-to-1 decision, not a surprise based upon the oral argument of many months ago, but says that the answer to that is yes, that the law is constitutional, that Mr. Rahimi and others like him can be prosecuted under this law, and the Second Amendment does, in fact, have limits. The particular circumstances of this case are dramatic, and they warrant some review here, because the Supreme Court wrestling plainly with probably one of the worst cases for the advancement, if you will, of gun rights in America, recognizing implicitly, if not explicitly, that they have before it a case where the extension of protections under the Second Amendment simply could not go forward. Mr. Rahimi was 23. He was facing not only multiple gun-related charges, but also says that after a judge had barred him from carrying weapons under a domestic violence protective order, he went on to engage in a reign of terror, basically participating in a string of 5 different shootings over just 2 months. A panel of U.S. judges in the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit wrote that he was hardly a model citizen. And again, during the course of the oral argument before the United States Supreme Court, the Chief Justice engaged Mr. Rahimi's counsel on whether or not there was any doubt that Mr. Rahimi is indeed a fully, hugely dangerous person. Ultimately, counsel having to acknowledge it, yes, indeed, he is a dangerous person. The Rahimi case here, dramatic in terms of what exactly he did. In December of 2019, Rahimi and his girlfriend get into an argument in a Texas parking lot. And during that fight, Rahimi knocked his girlfriend to the ground. He dragged her to his car, shoves her inside. And according to court records, when he realized that a bystander was watching, he pulled out a gun and fired a shot at that bystander. It gets worse. The girlfriend runs away from him, later calls her, threatens to shoot her if she tells anybody about what just happened. A Texas judge then issues a 2-year restraining order. February of 2020 is when this happens, and identifies all of this history. The judge at that time finds that Mr. Rahimi has committed family violence, and specifically finds that such violence was likely to occur again in the future. And as a part of that order, the judge explicitly tells Mr. Rahimi he cannot have a gun, cannot continue with his handgun license. According to all the records in this case, Rahimi, in the wake of that clear instruction, that domestic violence restraining order, goes on to do even more, flagrantly defying the court's order. In August of 2022, he reaches out to his girlfriend once again on social media, went to her house in the middle of the night. November of 2020, prosecutors say he threatened another woman with a gun, leading to his arrest on charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. After someone bought drugs from him, again later on, he fires an AR-15 into the man's house. The next day, during a traffic crash, they say he shot at a driver. He's accused of firing a gun into the air in a residential neighborhood 3 days after that. A few days after that, this kind of mayhem continues as we talk more here about what Mr. Rahimi did and how the Supreme Court of the United States of America reacted to this violence, basically assuring all of us that people like Mr. Rahimi cannot and will not be permitted to engage in future conduct like this. The law has some meaning, and we'll talk about exactly what the Supreme Court said in response to all of that. When
you're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Another dome in Washington, D.C. This one's the Heat Dome. Temperatures there, along with much of the Northeast, in the mid-90s right now. Galen Clark says it's better in Las Vegas, where she's from.
120 in Vegas, it's hot, but you have air conditioning everywhere you go. Every car has air conditioning. There's places to get out of the heat.
Threat of an escalation of fighting in the Middle East, with Hezbollah exchanging increasing fire with Israel from Lebanon. The group has said that it will not stop until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. This is Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, heads to Washington to meet face-to-face with U.S. officials, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is claiming that the U.S. has cut back on military supply shipments. The USS Theodore Roosevelt nuclear-powered aircraft carrier reaching port in South Korea for planned military drills, which also will include Japan. This just days after Russian President Putin's warning about arming North Korea. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
A Brewers comeback cut short. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It looked like the Brewers had made a tremendous comeback. Down 6-0, ninth inning, bases loaded, two outs. Bryce Terang at the plate on Fox Sports.
Burritos 1-2. In the air to left, Azokar started in, has to race back all the way to the corner, and it is gone! And Bryce Terang, with his second career grand slam, has completely shifted the complexion of this game in the ninth.
But the Brewers ended up losing 6-4 despite the grand slam. Milwaukee 0-3 in the series, heading into today's game. A recap coming up later tonight. Elsewhere, the last place Rockies beating the Nationals 8-7 thanks to a pitch clock violation. It was a tie game. Bottom of the ninth, the Rockies loaded the bases when the home plate umpire declared the Nationals pitcher Kyle Finnegan was 1 second too late throwing a pitch. It forced the game-winning run with an automatic walk. It's the first time a game has been won because of a pitch clock violation. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine for your Sunday. Some showers and storms, especially going into the afternoon. Highs climbing to the middle 70s, light northwest winds. Overnight, mostly clear. We'll see upper 40s and lower 50s. Sunshine on Monday. Right now, it's 73.
Pizza's here.
Oh, great. I'd love some, but I'm worried about my stomach issues.
If you're worried about having diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or loose, oily stools, it may not just be stomach issues. It could be a condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. With EPI, the pancreas doesn't release enough enzymes to break down food, but EPI is manageable. Use the symptom checker on identifyepi.com and talk to your doctor. That's identifyepi.com. Sponsored by AbbVie.
1, 2, 3.
What you doing?
4, 5, 6. Counting the first place awards from the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association.
WISS in Oshkosh for the best promo. WAUK in Waukesha, best Maggie Dawn Show web story. WMDX in Madison, best web story about the Max Inc. radio show. And WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids for best show, interview, and promo.
Informed, entertained, connected.
And winning.
Your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
What is the worst movie franchise?
Do you have one, Conrad?
What are your thoughts on Transformers?
I saw one Transformer movie. I think it was the first one. I didn't even know what the hell was going on.
I can't get into them anymore because, you know, it's the same every movie now.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be nice if you knew which Transformer. I know there's like testosterone and overload and whatever, testosterone.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
When I smoke weed, I get lost in the music. I like to isolate each instrument. The rhythmic bass, the harmonies on the piano, the sticky melody.
Hey, careful, babe. There's someone crossing the street.
Sorry, I didn't see him there.
If you feel different, you drive different. Don't drive high. It's dangerous and illegal everywhere. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, more and more UW-Madison students are interested in learning about public policy and sinkholes. Why? We'll find out. Join us.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Solarview. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour as well, talking about this major gun decision issued by the Supreme Court on Friday of just this past week, the Rahimi case. What is this all about? Why is this exposition of Mr. Rahimi's conduct so very important? It is important because the Supreme Court plainly understanding that it is working on a case involving someone who is indeed extremely violent, talking earlier about the extent to which Mr. Rahimi is a one-man terror organization with his use of firearms, not only shooting at people with whom he is engaged in drug transactions, during traffic crashes. He's accused of firing a gun in a residential neighborhood. A few days after that, after a truck flashes its headlights at him, he followed the truck and shot at that car. January, they say, of the same year, he fires shots in the air after a friend's credit card is declined at a Whataburger restaurant. During a search of Rahimi's bedroom in January of 2021, they find a loaded Glock and a rifle, along with a copy of the domestic violence restraining order, clearly indicating he is aware of the fact he is not to do any of that, and nonetheless thwarting that. He is prosecuted then, plainly by the federal prosecutors, for violating that federal law. The question whether or not that federal law is constitutional, the Supreme Court, 8-1, saying just this past week that yes, indeed, it is constitutional. This is a bridge too far, even for this Supreme Court that has in recent years given an awful lot of leeway to those people who would attack reasonable, rational, reasonable restrictions on gun use and abuse in America. So what does the Supreme Court in particular say? And how does it get around Bruin? This focuses upon this notion. The issue, of course, is whether or not there is a concept of domestic violence in the history of our nation. The reality is that that concept is relatively modern. It's a relatively contemporary concept. And an awful lot of people thought that this posed a tremendous conundrum, as indeed it does and did for the Supreme Court. Having to look back at a time when domestic violence and threats of domestic violence restraining orders were not a part of our general jurisprudence, therefore suggesting, consistent with Bruin and what the justice on the Supreme Court who authored Bruin, Clarence Thomas, would say, that because of that, that Mr. Rahimi does in fact get to carry a weapon, because indeed the law premised upon history is not supported by that history. Well, the Supreme Court rejects that notion just this past week. The United States Supreme Court, and in particular the Chief Justice, says this: when a restraining order contains a finding that an individual poses a credible threat to the physical safety of an intimate partner, that individual may, consistent with the Second Amendment, be banned from possessing firearms while the order is in effect. That's the Chief Justice John Roberts writing. He says this, and this is very important language because it basically is a carving back, a carving away at Bruin and this ultimate reliance, this complete reliance upon the past. He says, since the founding, again, going back to the past, our nation's firearms laws have included provisions preventing individuals who threaten physical harm to others from misusing firearms. Now, Clarence Thomas, again, who is the author of Bruin that focuses upon the past, he disagrees. He's the only dissenter. Clarence Thomas, the person who would apparently permit people like Mr. Rahimi to carry weapons in America, not just Texas, but around the nation. And Clarence Thomas, again, decides that this is not only contrary to his prior opinion in Bruin, but he simply cannot agree with it. He says the court and the government do not point to a single historical law revoking a citizen's Second Amendment right based on a possible interpersonal violence. He writes that the government has a better way to disarm dangerous people by prosecuting them for criminal violence. He says what the government cannot do, he said, is to strip the Second Amendment of any right of anyone subject to protective order, even if he has never been accused or convicted of a crime. Clarence Thomas, the only one dissenting, again, based upon Bruin and a very strict reading of Bruin, as the rest of the Supreme Court goes in the opposite direction, begins to carve out some sense that Bruin is not quite the strong principle that it was in the past. Court's three so-called liberal justices, they had dissented in Bruin when that was written in 2022 by Clarence Thomas. They wrote in this case, in Rahimi, they continue to think that that rule in Rahimi was a grave error, this history and invocation in all these cases. But in a pair of concurring opinions, they said that they were happy to embrace these new limits that the Supreme Court is now placing on Bruin, providing better direction to the lower courts as they understand what the Supreme Court's rule in this area is. Sonia Sotomayor, joined by Elena Kagan, welcomed what she called a clarification, which she's really saying is a diminution of the Bruin standard. She says the court's interpretation permits a historical inquiry calibrated to reveal something useful and transferable to the present day. While the dissent, and that is a reference to Clarence Thomas, would make the historical inquiry so exacting as to be useless, a too sensitive alarm that sounds whenever a regulation did not exist in an essentially identical form at the founding. That is really a refutation of everything that Bruin is all about. She adds that Justice Thomas's analysis would produce a very perverse result, as indeed it would here. Under the dissent's approach, she writes, the legislatures of today would be limited not by a distant generation's determination that such a law was unconstitutional, but by a distant generation's failure to consider that such a law might be necessary. In other words, bringing the past, upon which you can rely to some extent, into the future. That's what she's advocating for. She is joined by Ketanji Brown Jackson. Her own concurrence says the Bruin decision has left lower courts in a state of deep confusion. Indeed, it has. The Chief Justice's majority opinion, she wrote, was a tacit admission that lower courts are struggling. And she notes that the problem here is the result of what the Supreme Court has itself done. She says, in my view, the blame may lie with us, not with them. Significantly, in this case, where does the Chief Justice find some historical predicate for what's going on here? This requirement that people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders not be permitted to carry weapons. He does go back and he writes that old laws requiring people suspected of future misbehavior required to post surety bonds, S-U-R-E-T-Y, surety bonds, and that ones barring going armed to instill fear in others were sufficiently analogous to the domestic violence law. He's talking about things called going armed laws. And he says that together, these surety laws from the past, these going armed laws, confirm what common sense suggests. When an individual possesses a clear threat, I would add a present threat, again, bringing this contemporaneous to our present modern world. When an individual possesses a clear threat of physical violence to another, the threatening individual may be disarmed in the present, he writes. The challenged modern law is by no means identical to those founding era regimes, but it does not need to be, prompting an awful lot of people to say that the new standard announced by Rahimi, this modification of Bruin, is now that you don't need to find a twin in the past. You need to find something analogous. And indeed, you can, as many courts around the country have done in other cases, including in Illinois. Other courts have begun to find not only some predicates in the past, but also adopting the concept of a living constitution, saying the Second Amendment does indeed have some limits. That's in Heller. That's in Bruin as well. The Supreme Court has said previously that you can, in fact, impose limitations on the sale and restriction, the distribution. All kinds of things can be done. The Rahimi case is carving back Bruin, and it stands now as a major decision of the Supreme Court, not only in this docket of this term, but also going forward, and helps, in the words of the three so-called liberal justices, providing more definition to the lower courts who've been wrestling mightily since 2022, when Justice Thomas told us, you look exclusively to the past, no more. And as of Friday of this past week, a new basis upon which legislatures, local, state legislatures, even the federal legislature, can adopt and can put into place restrictions, reasonable, rational restrictions on the use of firearms that will keep us safe and secure. Those now effectively permitted by virtue of the Rahimi rule that carves back the Bruin rule quite dramatically. A very significant case in our nation's history, that just this past week. We do have a caller on the line, perhaps talking about Rahimi. Mark, glad to have you with us this morning. What is your inquiry, your question, or your comment? Glad to have you with us, Mark. Mark, are you with us? All right, Mark. Yes, Mark, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
My mind is kind of pulled in some different directions here. That yes, it is I kind of based this on Madison's Federalist 44, where he suggests that they didn't enumerate everything in the Constitution that Congress might need to do, because they didn't know what contingencies we might face as a nation. It's fascinating to me that a Supreme Court who has found almost an absolute right up to this point in time now that that people have the right to the persons have the right to keep and bear arms no matter what, that when they cannot find a right to vote in the Constitution, where it actually says the right to vote in the 14.2 of the Constitution, and that further amended to include universal suffrage for people over 18, that I'm being a little disjointed now because I'm collecting my thoughts together, but it is just fascinating to me that they cannot see an absolute right for the right of people to vote. They can't find that because it doesn't say it directly. Well, it does say it directly, and that they cannot find the right to privacy when Amendment 4 actually says persons have the right to be secure in their
Lots of inconsistencies there, right? Right. Absolutely, Mark. I appreciate the comments here, and specifically in the wake of what's happening here in the gun area, plainly a recognition by the Supreme Court that some of those inconsistencies cannot stand. And articulating just this past week, on Friday of this past week, this notion that going forward, there can be reasonable, rational limitations on gun rights, a major case coming out of the Supreme Court. Mark, appreciate your comments and perspectives on that as well. We've got another caller, Thomas, calling in. Thomas, glad to have your involvement in our discussion this morning as well.
Good morning. Thank you again for your very insightful show. I always learn a lot when I listen to you. I look forward to it every Saturday. I'm going to switch gears here just a little bit. Eileen Cannon, how is the laws written that we cannot accuse her or charge her with obstruction of justice? Because obviously everything that's going on there, it's like, come on now. This is just playing around. You're obstructing the government. You're obstructing our legal system with your
the way that you're handling this case, right? Right, right?
Yes, yes.
Right.
So why can't someone step up and say, this is obstruction of justice?
Right, and so Thomas, you know what we're going to do? I'm going to tantalize you and everyone else by saying I'm going to offer three D words we're going to get to in our second hour, perhaps prompting you to stay with me. I'm going to talk exactly about what your point is. We're going to talk about the distractions that she is causing. We're going to talk about the delays that she's causing and the disparaging that she is also engaging in. We'll talk a little bit more about her conduct. You're talking about, of course, about her whole course of conduct in overseeing the Mar-a-Lago documents case. I'm going to focus in particular, Thomas, at your invitation and already on my agenda on what's going on in Fort Pierce right now, identifying those distractions, those delays, those disparagements that she is engaging in for people like you and others prompt us to ask, why is she still on this case? And I'm going to recast your question appropriately offered here by you to suggest what are the remedies out there? What kinds of things can, in fact, be proposed to address this issue? I'll offer in our next hour some particular perspectives, Thomas, on exactly what can and perhaps cannot be done. The issue of prosecuting a federal judge for engaging this, perhaps a bridge too far in another area, but nonetheless, it expresses the outrage, I think, of many people looking at this case. And we'll talk more about that in our second hour. Appreciate that comment and also our invitation to the next hour discussion. Want to spend some time then talking more about the United States Supreme Court after this major case having to do with guns in particular. I want to spend some time talking about a second case that's flown pretty much under the radar here recently. It is a tax case. And yes, indeed, before you all tune out and think, gosh, he's now talking about taxes in America, what could be more mundane and less interesting on a weekend to talk about? The answer is that this particular case, Moore versus United States of America, is not only important in connection with what it does for the present income tax structure, having to do with one-time foreign income taxes, but also about the future prospects of something called the wealth tax. The wealth tax, much in our political discourse these days. I'm going to talk more about Moore versus United States, this major decision of just this past week, as Amicus, a law review, continues.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Do you have a loved one in a nursing home? California mega millionaire Eric Hovde has some bad news for you. He doesn't think they have long to live. It's true. In a recent interview, Hovde said, if you're in a nursing home, you only have a 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is at a point to vote. That's shocking. But it gets worse. One of Hovde's companies is named a co-defendant in a wrongful death suit from an incident at a California senior living facility. He even referred to himself as an expert in the nursing home business. Yikes, that doesn't sound like the kind of expert we need. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him that Wisconsin seniors deserve to vote and get the care they deserve. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, the Law Review, talking this morning as we are throughout our broadcast in our weekend presentations to you of all things Supreme Court about these major cases now coming out from the United States Supreme Court, talking about Rahimi, the significance not only for firearms, but also the diminution, the carving back, the pushback, if you will, on this notion that all things need to be seen through a lens of history. We saw even last week in this case involving intellectual property that Amy Coney Barrett also suggesting very, very loudly, taking on Clarence Thomas and saying that this unilateral, almost exclusive focus on history cannot stand, suggesting that inside the Supreme Court, there is a change going on to the good. We have not seen it completely, but certainly Rahimi is one of those examples of where a majority of the Supreme Court, not including Clarence Thomas, but a majority of the Supreme Court, including people like Sam Alito and Neil Gorsuch and certainly Amy Coney Barrett, looking at all of this, Brett Kavanaugh as well, certainly the Chief Justice who writes this opinion, saying it can't be just about history. It's got to be about contemporary issues as well. Speaking about contemporary issues, the Supreme Court weighing in sometimes in some political areas, even in the context of cases right before it. The Supreme Court on Thursday of this past week, the case is Moore versus United States, it's upholding a tax on foreign income that basically helped to finance the cuts, remember these, that President Donald Trump imposed way back in 2017. It's a case that many experts had cautioned, if it went in the other direction, could basically undercut completely our entire tax system. Again, significant because the Supreme Court did not go down that road. Brett Kavanaugh, writing for five justices, this is a 7-2 decision. He is joined by the Chief Justice, once again, John Roberts, and yes, indeed, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Those are the seven altogether who come together and make this determination. In a concurring opinions, Amy Coney Barrett and Sam Alito also explain that they agree with the upholding of the tax, but for different reasons. But all of them basically enter this major decision, Moore versus United States, that upholds a tax on foreign income that financed those cuts that President Trump at the time in 2017 imposed. The question before the justices seemed fairly simple and straightforward at a glance, but in fact, it's a little bit more complicated and has these political implications down the road about whether or not a wealth tax, not addressed by this opinion, but could in fact stand up against constitutional analysis. The question is whether or not, under the Constitution, which Congress which gives Congress some limited powers of taxation. Does this particular tax scheme survive? Justice Kavanaugh asserts in writing this. He says this court's longstanding precedents, reflected in and reinforced by Congress's longstanding practice, established that the answer is yes, we can support this particular tax scheme. He basically nodded to some broader issues at play over the limits of federal tax power, but said those were potential issues for another day. And he's talking about this future possibility of a wealth tax being imposed. The ruling here preserves what is basically the structure of the income tax system for now. It avoids what many people, much more sophisticated in tax law than I will ever be, many analysts, many economists warn could have been fiscal chaos if this system had been struck down. It also opened this window for what could be the next major tax case to come before the court sometime, maybe next term, maybe the term beyond that. And that is whether or not Congress can indeed impose what is effectively sort of a tax on Americans' wealth. Now, President Biden and other Democrats have proposed to do just that in various forms. And that question, even though it wasn't decided here, looms large in these opinions. The majority opinion, the concurrences written by Amy Coney Barrett, Sam Alito, and others, all of this kind of in the background. It's looming large, highlighting the stark divisions among these justices in how they view the notion of a wealth tax. In her concurrence on this, Ketanji Brown Jackson laid out what was essentially a roadmap, if you will, doesn't have to do this, but in her concurrence, a roadmap for the government to defend such a tax. She praised the majority for wisely taking a restrained approach in issuing a narrow ruling. That's what courts often do. She acknowledges that more tax fights like this are likely to reach the court in the future. Indeed, they will. And she cautions her fellow justices about what should be approaching down the road if such disputes with similar discipline come before the court. She said this, "I have no doubt that future Congresses will pass and future presidents will sign taxes that outrage one group or another, taxes that strike some as demanding too much, others as asking too little." But she added this, she said, historical examples show that such disagreements were best settled by voters, not the justices. That's Ketanji Brown Jackson also giving a nod, if you will, to this history focus, which we've been talking a lot on this broadcast this weekend and previously. Still, even so, some conservatives on the Supreme Court, including two who supported upholding this tax, argued that a hypothetical wealth tax could violate the Constitution's guidelines, its basic principles out there, including those that are set forth in what you all know to be the 16th Amendment, and then about what federal taxes must look like. Amy Coney Barrett, for example, in a concurring opinion, wrote that she agreed with the court's ultimate holding in this case. She said that a different tax, for example, a tax on shareholders of a widely held or domestic corporation, would present a different case. She's signaling that down the road, she might decide differently if the facts were different. And in his sharp dissent, once again, you've got Clarence Thomas arguing that the majority upheld the tax only by ignoring the question presented, he says. He says that here again, the text and the history of the 16th Amendment make it clear that it requires a distinction between income and the source from which that income is derived. This is Clarence Thomas, once again, back to his old themes about history and the textual basis for what we should be doing here. And he says that 16th Amendment income is only realized income. We should not have hesitated to say so. In this case, he dissents. No, so it brings up what this case is all about. It's worth traveling down this road just a bit to understand where this comes from and why it is that this particular tax case is so important, not only for the tax structure presently, but what might happen down the road. It involves a Washington State couple. Their names are Charles and Kathleen Moore. They challenged this law, this basic predicate law, that they were required to pay about $15,000 in taxes stemming from their investment in a company in India that was supplying rural farmers. Okay, the couple was backed by something called the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and that's a free market research organization in Washington. Now, going further into some of the details, and they are, in the court opinion, important to understand. Their investment in India fell under what is an otherwise fairly obscure provision, thus some obscurity to the entire case, called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, that altered how the federal government taxes corporate profits and those earned abroad. I'm going to talk more about what that particular law of 2017 that supported the tax cuts at that time meant.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Capital Times entertainment reporter Rob Thomas and Wisconsinology website creator, director, and producer Frank Anderson joins the show.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast format? Search no more. Find it now on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com. Your news just for the Superior area. I'm James Kelly with WBZH News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.